framework questions.
All right, why don't you start and see if we start to say it.
This is an interview with Robert Hauser on January 16th, 1985. We're talking in his office in the Social Science Building. I'm Laura Smail, and doing the interview for the University Archives Oral History Project. Well, the first thing to ask you about is where your family background and what took you into academic life and into sociology.
That's a good way to start such an interview, I guess, especially when you're in my business. My dad was a chemist, ABD at the University of Chicago, cut off by the Manhattan Project for security clearance, and all thesis research had to be related to it at some stage of the game.
Cut off in finishing his
work. He couldn't dissertate. My mother was a social worker, also Chicago. But in terms of the direction that my work has taken, the model for me was my uncle Phil Hauser, who is still at age 75 a extremely active sociologist, demographer, ran the Department of Sociology at the University of Chicago for about 20 years, from the early 50s, I think, until the early 1970s. And he really led me into the field, in part through the kind of work he did, because I'm also a demographer and ecologist, or at least started out that way, but more through the model of his career as I was able to observe it. Also, by pointing me in the direction of some good teachers, one of whom ended up eventually being my dissertation advisor at the University of Michigan. I went to Chicago as an early entrant in 1959. I think it was a year before I was supposed to graduate from high school.
Did you question that you might go somewhere else, or you just take?
That was the only place that would let me get away from home that quickly.
Oh,
it was.
You couldn't get
it was
very
my
far
mother
away
and I
from
couldn't stand
home,
one another any longer at that time, and I was ready to leave home, and the University of Chicago, my folks had both gone to Chicago, and it was the only place we knew of that would accept people who hadn't graduated from high school, and I applied and got in, and so I went. It was that simple. They thought I would be somewhat supervised there because my Uncle Phil and his wife, my Aunt Zelda, were both living adjacent to the campus, and I would generally stop by their place for Sunday brunch.
So you didn't live adjacent to the campus, I gather.
Well, no, I lived on campus.
I mean, your family, didn't, your parents?
No. At that time, my parents lived in Silver Spring, Maryland, a suburb of Washington.
Oh, I see.
My father was oh my gosh, I forget what his title was. Anyway, he was in effect second in line to the medical director of the Food and Drug Administration. He had some fancy title, but I can't.
So I somehow thought you were brought up in Chicago.
No.
That is quite
I was born in Chicago and I lived there. My dad had been a food and drug inspector and we lived there until I was seven. In 1949, we moved to Washington where he went into the Washington office of FDA.
Mm-hmm.
stayed there until he retired. And then I moved back to Chicago in 1959 when I started at the university. In any event, the other thing so Phil was around when I was an undergraduate and didn't really pay too much attention to me, nor I to him, but he was around. The only great influence that I can remember his having directly on my undergraduate career, actually two I can recall. One is that he got me a job working for a former associate of his as a kind of a statistical clerk and Boy Friday. This was a social statistician named Martin Tatel, who had had a bout with schizophrenia sometime midway in his life and had just come out of the hospital, suddenly had a complete remission and wanted to pick up his life again and get going. And so I worked for him as a statistical clerk. That was an interesting job, and I managed to work in Phil's research center, the Population Research and Training Center. So I got acquainted there with a couple of people. I remember particularly Reynolds Farley, who's now a professor at Michigan and with whom I work occasionally, was a graduate student at the time when I was an undergraduate, and we were both sitting there punching Marchant calculators.
But you were majoring in economics.
I was majoring in economics, but that was a fluke. That was an accident. That brings up the other influence that Phil had on me at that stage of the game. Basically, I wasn't majoring in anything. I hope they don't keep copies of my undergraduate transcript, but it wasn't very good. And I took some math, but somehow in this, the one thing that I lost in terms of training in this early transition was completing high school mathematics in an orderly fashion. And I just wasn't quite clever enough to make the transition to college math smoothly and lost out somewhere along the line. So that I ended up in my first year in college taking calculus and taking statistics. I'll describe that too. I guess that's worth talking about. But I really couldn't cut the material very well. I did rather badly at it. And I just kind of floundered around from one major to another until some point when I wrote to my parents. I think sometime late in my third year of school, must have been just before the beginning of the third quarter, and told them that it wasn't clear that I was going to graduate in 4 years because it wasn't clear that I had a major in anything. And at that point, they panicked, I think, and either wrote or called Phil and said, do something. So he sat down with me and went through my transcript and matched what I had done with all of the majors available at the college.
<I see. laughs>
And we discovered that with the only thing that, given what I had taken, that I could graduate with in 4 years was economics. So I started taking courses in economics. In fact, I don't know that I really, I think I passed what I took, but I don't think that I was very interested in what I was taking, nor did I show up very much. Chicago had a pattern, which I don't know if they still follow, of not requiring people to show up for classes. And I adhered to that to the letter. I was actually interested in research by that time, and I was doing some things that I thought were much better.
It's sociological research.
Sort of sociological research. Yeah, I guess I should describe that. at any rate, that was one of that. Those were two of the things that Phil. Let me finish up with Phil here. Those were two of the things that Phil was involved with, and the third came in my choice of graduate schools, because he was the one who I had applied to graduate school in in several different subjects and several different institutions, because my undergraduate record was so crummy that I wasn't sure who would accept me at what, and I was just prepared to take anybody who would offer to take me in and provide enough support so that I wouldn't have to be supported by my parents any longer. So I applied to graduate schools in economics, in law, in operations research, and in sociology. And actually, as it turned out, I must have had something going for me because I did get accepted fairly decent places in all of those fields, but he kind of twisted my arm, and the University of Michigan offered me a good fellowship, and Phil recommended Amos Hawley and Al Reese and Otis Dudley Duncan to me, all of whom were then at Michigan, and said that's the place I ought to go, so that's where I went.
Why were you sure you wanted to go to graduate school?
Never occurred to me to do anything else. I can't remember at any time thinking that I wouldn't.
Well, what? Why did they take you if your grades weren't good?
I'm not sure. I guess I had pretty good GRE scores. And I also had an interesting, what may have appeared to be a rather interesting work history by that time, because I had been working in research of one sort or another since about the time I was 14.
I saw you had a job down in North Carolina or something.
No, it was in
like
Maryland.
Maryland.
It was in Maryland. Oh. There was a guy who was the founder of Operations Research, who's now, I think, long since dead, named Ellis Johnson, who had started this kind of holistic, quantitative scheme of analyzing real problems. When he was working for the Army at some point, I think somewhere in the middle of World War II, although I don't believe it really got started, really got rolling until the Korean War. And he was set up by the Army in an outfit that was somehow connected with Johns Hopkins University called ORO, the Operations Research Office of Johns Hopkins University. And this guy was probably as close to being a real genius as anybody I've ever met, with the exception of Sewell Wright. And basically, the way people dealt with him was to lock him up in a room and let him slip pieces of papers with ideas out. And one of his ideas was that that there was a clear decline of productivity, or not productivity, of creativity with age, that teenagers were at peak in terms of real creativity. So that if you could find problems for them to deal with that were within their grasp in terms of their level of technical skill and general knowledge, that they could probably do extraordinary things with them that overtrained adults couldn't possibly do. And he took some of the money that the Army gave him and set up a summer training program at the ORO, where there must have been somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 or 25 kids hired each summer to work at a salary which was, in current dollar terms, would still look attractive to hourly students here today. I think I was paid in 19, let's see, I must have started it when I was 14. That was in, can I count, 1956, something like that. Or summer of 57, I must still have been 14. And I think they paid us about $3 or $3.50 an hour to start. So there was a lot of money in that. Up to that point, I'd worked as a camp counselor. They took kids' names on recommendation of their high school science counselors or some of their science teachers, and then gave them tests. I think we had to invent a way of continuous production and harvesting and processing of sweet peas or something like that in order to earn this job.
I suppose this has been written up somewhere.
There was a woman named Jean Taylor who was running the program, and I believe she wrote it up, but I had never seen, or if I've seen it, I've now lost whatever article was or two was written on the subject. But they did attempt to publish. There was some publicity about it at the time. In any event, once they'd chosen this group of people, they brought them into the outfit, which did a lot of classified research, and gave people, created groups, usually with an older and more experienced trainee carried over from the previous summer, some kind of a problem to deal with. and just said, go do it. We have all these facilities. We have all this, all sorts of staff. See what you can accomplish. You've got access to all the libraries in Washington, whatnot. See what you can accomplish. I got stuck my first summer there working on a linear programming problem. It was a model to find the maximum number of people who could be supported on the Earth on a minimum cost diet, given various constraints in terms of the mix of nutrients that had to be provided and various sorts of crops and land, quality land, and all sorts of funny things like that. And we managed somehow to produce some numbers by the end of the summer, although I wouldn't give a fig for
grand
it now.
For the imagination.
And then the next summer, they decided to make it more complicated, and we did nonlinear programming. Now, nowadays, nonlinear programming is something that still presents great computational problems, I think, relatively serious computational problems. Linear programming is something now that you can buy a package for a couple hundred dollars that'll work on any microcomputer. But at the time, they had this huge UNIVAC, I think it was called an 1170 or something like that. It was still a tube-type computer in a giant room with units failing constantly, being, one tube after another being pulled out on drawers. And we worked this thing endlessly with a nonlinear programming problem and never found the solution space, the area of the space created by these various constraints on production and consumption, within which you could find any kind of a solution, not necessarily an optimal solution. So in terms of the mathematics and computation involved, it was a disaster. The data were also a disaster. We used Japan as a test case for this, and it turned out, we learned later on, that Japan seemed to produce incredibly detailed statistics on agricultural productivity, where you could find out exactly how many nutrients were and of what sort of nutrients were used on each little hectare of land, and exactly what crops were produced and how much, and so on and so forth. Tremendous detail for small areas of the country. With all these input and output data year after year after year. Well, it turns out, we learned after the fact, that these numbers had been produced using some kind of a production function of the sort that we were trying to estimate with them, or something like that. It was a bit of a disaster. But anyway, I developed some taste for doing research there. And while I was there, one of the people who supervised my work was a black woman named Joyce Whitley, who had in another life been an urban planning consultant. She had had a master's degree in urban planning from the city of Chicago that she obtained in a program that was created as some kind of a handmaiden to the Hyde Park Kenwood urban renewal project. And she eventually left ORO and went back to Chicago and went to work again for a man named Jack Meltzer, who had also been a part of this, had been a participant in this, I think it was by then defunct, master's program, but had become an independent urban renewal and city planning consultant with rather vague but clearly subservient ties to the University of Chicago and its various activities outside the university. And what happened was, when Julian Levy, who was head of he was director of the Southeast Chicago Commission. When Julian Levy called, everybody ran and did exactly what he said. And that's just the way this operation worked. In any event, what happened is that I continued to work for the operations research office through the summers, up through that between my third and fourth years at the university. That was a point. I had always worked on non-classified research projects. Although some people worked on military projects, none of the things that I did ever had any military significance. And by that time, the Vietnam War was beginning to brew. They had people in there doing things that were related to support to intelligence, related to support for covert operations in Vietnam. My family had had a somewhat checkered political history, and I had no interest in getting involved in that. And meanwhile, Joyce Whitley turned up in Chicago working for this fellow Meltzer and asked me if I would be interested in working part-time for this outfit as a kind of a research assistant. I jumped at the chance to do that, and then that worked out during the course of the year, and maybe I should say a little more about it. But by the next summer, I think I went ahead far enough to get some kind of a security clearance, but I decided, and I think I may even have been offered a permanent position at a kind of an entry, professional entry level by this operations research outfit.
What year is this?
It must have been in the summer of 63.
Hmm.
Or just the spring of 63, because mm-hmm. that's when I graduated from college. But by that point, I decided I did not want to go on with the operations research outfit. And instead, I stayed on with Meltzer until the end of that summer, and then went off to Michigan to start graduate school. Now, while I was working for Meltzer, I got my first taste of social research in the sense in which I would now think of it.
Before you get onto that, is your family's checkered political career of any interest, or?
I'm not sure.
Effect on
Well.
What is this, being hounded by McCarthy?
Yeah. Not directly, but just as a part of the general,
that era.
Of the general, as a minor accompaniment to that. My paternal grandfather was a communist and a Wobbly. He was a tailor. I think he stayed active in the party until sometime around the end of the war, at which point my Uncle Phil said, it's time to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did, although that's where his sympathies lay in some respects for the rest of his life. Unlike my Uncle Phil, who sort of marched through graduate school and went into the university and never paid much attention at all to his father, my father was more respectful and got involved in a minor way in party activities up through the time, I think sometime during his college career. And he had never much cared for this stuff. He really was apolitical. He really didn't care about politics much at all. But his past was sufficiently well recorded so that sometime beginning during World War II, when he had a slightly sensitive post with FDA, he began to get questioned periodically by security people. And he ended up being suspended and having a loyalty hearing in 1949 and again, I think, in 1953 or 1954. And each time he was cleared, and eventually he ended up, I think about the time Kennedy came in, he ended up with some reasonable low-level security clearance. But it was a real serious problem throughout my childhood for us. Not the not the politics of it particularly, just the effect it had, the disruption it created in our lives. During the first period, during that first hearing, I really don't have any first-hand recollection of it anymore, but during that first hearing, I think that we went for most of a year without any income, because at that period of time, they simply suspended people
without
pay.
They never talked about that.
And they never, gave you any back pay if you were reinstated. And during the later period, Eisenhower had somewhat reformed the procedures. I don't remember exactly what the circumstances were, but I think in effect, I think my dad was basically permitted to continue to work until it was cleared up. I don't think there was any problem of that sort the second time. In fact, there's a minor connection with the University of Wisconsin in that, because the my dad's lawyer is a guy named Alex Elson, whose daughter is Robert O'Neill's wife.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Karen
O'Neill. Yeah. Anyway.
And also, I'm just curious.
Sure.
You said Johnson, they kept the door shut, and he slipped notes under. Has somebody written up why that is? Did you know him?
Yeah. Well, oh yeah, he was around during the period that I was there. Although I think he may have been turned out of the place by the Army sometime during the period. Has replaced as director sometime during the period that I worked there, because he was, if I recollect correctly, this is all very vague, but I think he was opposed to the war, and was rather strong to the development of the Vietnam War, and was rather strong in his opinions, and the Army did not want to tolerate him in a position. I mean, this was their equivalent to the Rand Corporation. Everybody hears about the Rand Corporation and how the Air Force created that, and their, although they do lots of other things now that don't involve Air Force money, they're essentially a creation of the Air Force. Well, ORO was the Army's version of the same thing, a place where they could obtain some, at least somewhat independent research advice and not be constrained by the salary levels and other kinds of bureaucratic constraints of an in-house operation.
Okay.
Let me see where I'm going for that. Oh, anyway, so I went to work for Jack Meltzer, and I don't remember everything that I did there, but I ended up, one of the things that I was basically a statistical clerk, and I did a lot of work with social characteristics for small areas in the city of Chicago, dealing with such matters as the evaluation of the economic worth of commercial property, and also the feasibility of redevelopment in one way or another. On the first side, I remember we did a lot of work on the decline of the neighborhood movie theater.
Wait.
He's always dictated, which I never do. That's one of the things he wishes he taught me how to do. He doesn't like my sitting at these terminals banging away.
This is side two, tape one, the interview. So,
where was I? The University of Chicago was busy buying up properties around the university. They were trying to recover all the territory that had been lost to university ownership during the Hutchins era. Basically, we and the university were in the business of trying to show that the economic worth of neighborhood theaters had declined substantially. Of course, the owners of the property were trying to claim that it was that they were still going concerns. So we did a little history on the land. On the location of theaters and patterns and locations of theaters over time. The other thing that I can remember our doing two other things, one of which led into my master's thesis, as a matter of fact. It's interesting to think about these things again. One of the things that we did was a study of the feasibility of high rent residential development in the Central Business District. This was just about the time that Marina Towers went up, and that was the first major new residential building in the area right around the Loop. And people wanted to know, was this just some kind of a quirk, or was there a real market for housing like this? And if so, what was the nature of the market? What did people want? Who were they? So we hired a commercial survey outfit, Leo Shapiro and Associates. He was a former student of my Uncle Phil's. This is all incestuous.
Inbred,
yes, inbred. And to do a survey of people's attitudes towards housing in the residential area. And I guess the part of it, actually, it was the same project. Part of it that I was involved in was a study of zoning for residents, what the relationship was between zoning and building types, what it was like in different places in the country, what kinds of changes might be necessary in order to make it feasible to do the kind of residential building that would be economically viable in the Central Business District. The bottom line was that residential zoning has essentially been designed, on the one hand, to provide safety and to allow provision of public services, but the key issue is really when you zone for resident, that if I recall it, is that when you zone for residents, you're trying to create an environment which is safe for children and which appropriate services are available for children. Well, all those rules are obsolete when it comes to building for the CBD. What people want is accessibility and a view. And if you can provide those two things for them, plus basic city services, then there's a market for
What's CBD?
Central Business District.
Oh.
Okay. Somewhere in the course of that, I read a lot of zoning law and regulation, and I started reading about the development of the Central Business District in Chicago. I read, what's the guy's name? Earl Johnson's doctoral thesis at Chicago, which was a massive study of the Central Business District. And I read Homer Hoyt's doctoral thesis, which was both in sociology, mind you, which was called a classic called 100 Years of Land Values in Chicago. And those really got me interested. The combination of working with small area data on that theater project and reading about the history of the of land use in general and the Central Business District in particular really got me interested in urban ecology. Urban renewal was a very big thing then. And what I had in mind in choosing a graduate school was to find something that I could do that would give me additional training in research on land use and land values, and then permit me to go into real estate law.
I see.
That's what I was going to do.
That certainly.
I remember.
You certainly didn't make it, did you?
No, I remember when the night after I had my dissertation defense. I went to dinner major advisor Dudley Duncan and his wife Beverly, who's also a sociologist and demographer, and Beverly told me that she still remembered the application that I'd written to graduate school at the University of Chicago, and she told me then that she had never seen such a bunch of crap in her life. It was great.
Can I interrupt you now?
Sure.
Because you're speaking of history made me remember I wanted to ask you a question about your undergraduate life. Did you take other courses? Did other things interest you besides economics and math and sociology?
Yeah, I can. Well, not very much. I'll put it that way.
That's the wrong way to word the question. But.
I don't. Well, I don't recall very much about what I took or why or. or what I did. I remember only very few things about my undergraduate schooling. I remember I took a course in genetics once, and I thought that was quite fascinating.
That wasn't with Sewell Wright, was it?
No, it was with some young guy who I think died rather soon after that. He took a real interest in me. That was one of the few times I had anybody in the faculty at Chicago interested in me. My impression was at Chicago when I was an undergraduate that, by and large, people there didn't give a hoot about undergraduates, which I think is objectively true from the perspective I have now as knowing some of the people on the faculty in a different way. And that they occasionally would pick out someone who, for some obscure reason, seemed particularly promising and lavish resources on them. But the average student at Chicago, who was still pretty darn bright, was essentially ignored by people there. And I felt rather thoroughly ignored and somewhat bitter about the place the whole time I went there. And my way of accommodating with that was, on the one hand, and by the time I was a senior year and felt reasonably secure that I could get through courses, was to go take an outside job where I thought I could make some money and have some fun and really learn something and do some things that interested me. Also, I learned how to use a library. At the time, that was rather tricky, because one of the things that burned me up about the university was that at the time, undergraduates were not permitted to go into the stacks at Harper Library. However, I had two ways around that. There are a lot of subsidiary libraries, many of which also had pretty good collections in the social sciences, so that I remember I used, I think it was Swift, which was a theological library or something like that, but it had some great stuff in it, and I could go up into the stacks in Swift and just spend hours browsing through the collection and reading this, that, and the other thing. And I could generally get by writing term papers at the last minute because I knew nobody else would use the stacks there, and so they would always have enough books on any given subject so that I could always go in until a day before a paper was due and find something interesting just by wandering through the stacks and write up a whole lot of it. And then by this urban planning outfit had some special status again with the university, so that as their employee, although not in my role as an undergraduate, I had some kind of privileged access to the university library facilities. Now I gather they've changed those rules, but that really burned me up at the time. What else do I recall doing at the university? There was one course that was quite important that I took during my first year there, and that was a statistics course. I didn't do very well at it, but it turns out, more or less by accident, that it was the same course that graduate students in sociology took then and have taken, or took for many years thereafter. It was written, because the text was written by the guy who gave the course. The guy was a man named K.A. Brownlee, and his book was called Statistical Theory and Methodology in Science and Engineering. He taught it out of his first edition, which meant that I spent much of the term correcting his typographical errors for him. And it was a remarkably modern statistics course. He did everything using maximum likelihood estimation, which is everybody's favorite scheme for generating statistical estimators nowadays, or has been, or certainly one of the favorite schemes nowadays. And generally, statistics wasn't done that way at that time, certainly not for people who were in the social sciences. I had to learn how to do computation, which was probably the first real skill that I had. We were doing 3- and 4- and 5-way analyses of variance by hand by the end of this course, and you really had to come up with the right numbers. So I learned a lot about calculation and about diligent effort and about accuracy and care in recording things, and that carried me all the way through graduate school.
You took it in preparation for expectation that you needed. Was that it? Wasn't just
idle
curiosity.
No, it wasn't idle. I don't remember exactly what made me take it, to tell you the truth. I think, again, probably my Uncle Phil advised that I take it, because it was a good thing for people to have taken some statistics, in the same sense in which you would say it's a good thing to learn some history. Now, most people wouldn't give you that advice, but or at least not to take a something approaching a math stat course very early in your undergraduate career. But at any rate, that's the advice I got, so that's what I did. And that really prepared me for a lot of things that came later on. I didn't, when I'm supposedly a social statistician and but the fact of the matter is that that's as close as I've ever had to a real course in statistics. I've had to kind of float through, I think I had to float through some one other course when I was a graduate student, but in fact it was a lower level course and it was just a review of the material that I had had as an undergraduate. So it's basically that one thing, and plus my own occasional efforts that have carried me through in statistics ever since then. I'm really jealous of the students that I turn out now, who I won't generally let out the door unless they're much better trained than I am. They have to take a real math stat course and linear algebra. I never completed a course in linear algebra, and make them take Art Goldberger's econometrics course, they're just generally better trained than I ever was or ever will be. Anyway, so that's the.
Did you go to a private school?
No, no. I went to. You mean as in high school?
The reason I'm asking is that you spoke of proofreading a book, it occurs to me that the average undergraduate now wouldn't know if anything was misspelled. And
proofreading.
Yes, you said when you read the first edition of his book that you saw
yeah.
errors. That it just
yeah.
struck me.
No. No, I wish. Yeah, I wish kids would find error nowadays. No, I was just. Well, everybody in the class was doing this in effect. I mean, we were working through this thing, and obvious. Well, Mr. Brownlee evidently hadn't proofread it, so somebody had to. No, I went to Montgomery Blair High School, which is most famous nowadays as the school to which Goldie Hawn and Connie Chung went. And Sylvester Stallone.
You've got me on all those three. I don't know.
You know, Goldie Hawn is this Hollywood actress. She's a comedian. She's done things with Chevy Chase and oh my gosh! In fact, she's been around for quite a while. She did. There was a program called on television, probably a long time ago now, maybe 15 years ago, called Laugh-In. And she got her start on television, prancing around the stage half nude in this show, whenever it was. And actually, she's quite smart. She now has her own production company and directs her own films, evidently quite clever person. Anyway. Sylvester Stallone is the actor who plays this boxer in Rocky, this movie that he's now made three or four times in a row under different titles. He's quite successful also. Anyway, definitely public school. So where does that leave us? I guess I got to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in zoning at the time, coming out of that project working on the Central Business District. And um, supported, I think, my first year in graduate school as in a program called the Metropolitan Community Research Program or something like that. It was an interdisciplinary, there was an interdisciplinary seminar in population, geography, human ecology, and related subjects, which carried a full term, a full support with it, and was directed by Amos Hawley, who is probably the only real theorist that human ecology has had in the post-war period. Absolutely brilliant man, whom I found absolutely nothing to talk to about. And I wrote a paper which I ultimately got. I wrote two papers, I guess. One was some kind of a paper on land use and zoning theory. And then I wrote another paper on the effects of city characteristics on types of city expenditure. And I think I gave one of them to Hawley and I gave the other one to Al Reese. So they both, I think, ended up thinking that I had done reasonably well. And somewhere along the line, Hawley decided to go off to a warmer climate. So he left Michigan for North Carolina in semi-retirement. And I ended up getting dumped onto into an office next door to Dudley Duncan at the Population Research and Training Center. I don't remember exactly how I was supported for the rest of the time I was at Michigan. Some of the money came from that research center, some of it came from various NIMH grants. But the gist of it was that somehow they had marked me out as someone reasonably special. And as a graduate student, you never quite know how or why these decisions get made. But the difference between the way I was treated throughout my graduate career and that of most of my fellow students, some of whom, several of whom are now colleagues of mine here, is that I never had to do any work for anybody else. I was basically supported to be an independent scholar and hang around. And I became Dudley Duncan's student without ever working for him, which was pretty unusual. He was known as being an extraordinarily tough guy to work with. The basic idea was that he was not nice, he was just honest and a very serious fellow and very, very caustic as a critic. He had an open door policy, which is something that few professors manage to have, and I always try to do it, but I'm gradually hiding behind signs and things like that. It's extraordinary that he could get away with it, and the reason he could get away with it was because nobody ever came in unless they had something serious to talk about. Because if they didn't, they would get royally chewed up. And even if they did have something serious to talk about, the chances were fairly good that you would come out feeling somewhat brutalized, but you'd learn just a hell of a lot. He was just an extraordinarily insightful and serious guy, so if you were prepared to be beaten around the ears a little bit, you could learn a tremendous lot from him. I don't remember specifically what I worked on until I got to my dissertation stage. I guess I can recall a couple of things that were reasonably important in my graduate training. One, probably of tremendous importance, having nothing to do with Duncan, was the Detroit Area Study. The Detroit Area Study was a project which had been set up in the early or mid-50s, I think, originally, maybe mid-50s. Originally, Bud Sharp, who runs the Wisconsin Survey Research Lab, I think, was the first director of this outfit. And it was kind of a cooperative arrangement between social science departments and the Institute for and the Survey Research Center of the Institute for Social Research at Michigan, where each new cohort of graduate students in sociology and occasionally in other disciplines would go through a complete cycle of survey operations, starting out with attempting to define a problem or series of problems, developing an instrument, pre-testing it, then going out into the field and beginning production interviews with some kind of a household sample from the Detroit metropolitan area. Then that cycle would break off in the spring. That's as far as they could carry it during the course of an academic year. And in the late spring and the early summer, SRC interviewers would complete the rest of the interviews, and they'd kind of clean up the data and give you a nice, fresh, but not quite error-free set of cards in the fall, and you were expected to write a research paper about them. And the research paper, it took care of a lot of things. It trained people pretty well on how to do surveys, and it substituted, this paper substituted for a master's degree requirement in Michigan's program, and gave people firsthand experience in dealing with data that they had had a part in collecting and doing some analysis on the one hand, and on the other hand, it didn't burden the department with crummy master's theses. They could just throw them away when they were done, which is what ought to be done with most master's level work. And that was something that I really found very rewarding. And the second year that I was there, I was selected to be, so I do remember more about how I supported. The second year that I was there, that metropolitan community thing ended, and I was given a teaching assistantship on the Detroit area study, which meant that I was was a workhorse on the project and an advisor to the next cohort of graduate students. So I went through the cycle a second time.
This just goes on a little bit more, but.
Okay. At any rate, by the time I finished that second cycle, I felt fairly comfortable in doing surveys, and a lot of my work since then has depended really on two, or one might say three, surveys that I've done. In fact, it's conceivable that I could spend the rest of my life working and never collect any more data, just continuing to work on those three surveys. So I no longer consider myself at the state of being at the leading edge in survey methods, but I do have some data that are worth analyzing. In any event, so after the Detroit area study, that must have been after my second year, is when I must have ended up on the Dudley Duncan's doorstep and went through school from then on at his feet. I had the minimum amount of training in demography. Unfortunately, I'm terribly undertrained in demography as I am in statistics, possibly much worse trained in demography, I think. I took the basic demographic methods course from a fellow named Dave Goldberg, who was at the time interested primarily in preferences for numbers of children, and was trying to understand some psychometrician scheme called, it was a Clyde Coombs unfolding theory for measuring preferences. And he spent most of the term that I was supposedly taking basic demographic methods trying to teach us unfolding theory instead of teaching us anything about demography. And it was a terrible waste of time. I would have liked to learn about unfolding theory, but not then. So what did finally turn me on? There were two things that finally turned me on in graduate school. One was that I was there while kind of looking on, but not really participating, while Dudley Duncan was finishing up his work with Peter Blough on a project called Occupational Changes in a Generation. I started graduate school at Michigan in 64, and the Blough-Duncan book was published in 1967, which means that it must have been mostly done during my first 2 years or 2.5 years of graduate, maybe 3 years, 2.5 years, say, of graduate school. And that was a book which turned out to be just tremendously influential on the, both in terms of the what we know about social stratification and inequality, and what the directions that work in that area have taken during the past 15-20 years, and also has was at the same time extremely influential in its effect on the way, the kind of statistical work, the kind of statistical models that people used, not only in sociology, but throughout the social or quasi social sciences. What Duncan did, I think, perhaps not as an independent act on his part, but picking up on some things that he had learned from one of his earlier star graduate students, Robert Hodge, was to rediscover the work of Sewell Wright on path analysis. Should I
quit? Is that okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.